910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Aldinger. A couple Republican Senate primaries could determine the balance of the Senate this November. ABC News projects former Maryland Governor Larry Hogan will win the state's GOP primary.
You know, they said the Hogan brand of politics was dead. Well, once again, we proved them wrong tonight.
West Virginia Governor Jim Justice, meanwhile, is projected to win his state's GOP Senate primary. The Justice Department's informed a federal judge that Boeing violated a settlement which allowed the company to avoid criminal prosecution after two deadly crashes involving its 737 MAX jets. The Biden administration has approved more than $1 billion in arms and ammunition to send to Israel. Another shipment of heavy bombs remains on hold. Florida State Police arrested the driver of a pickup truck which crashed into a bus early this morning carrying farm workers, killing eight, injuring dozens. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. A healthcare system serving eastern Wisconsin is working with the FBI to try to unfreeze their computers. Ascension health officials confirmed last week a ransomware attack has frozen their computer system. Ascension isn't saying how much money the hackers want. The University of Wisconsin-Madison Extension is using a $1 million federal grant to teach the public about large-scale solar and wind farms in different communities. Extension's Sherry Gruder says communities are also urged to give feedback.
Endangered species in the area, will they be protected to what happens to the water and the wells when the land isn't being farmed for that time?
33 large-scale solar developments are in place or under development in Wisconsin. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
1, 2, 3.
What you doing?
4, 5, 6. Counting the first place awards from the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association.
WISS in Oshkosh for the best promo. WAUK in Waukesha, best Maggie Dawn Show web story. WMDX in Madison, best web story about the Max Sync radio show. And WFHR in Wisconsin Rapids for best show, interview, and promo.
Informed, entertained, connected.
And winning.
Your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more at civicmedia.us.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. It's National Infrastructure Week. That's right. We're going to be talking about infrastructure, and not like we did during the Trump years where we had a lot of gimmicks, a lot of glitz, a lot of glam, some photo ops, cute little pictures, little hard hats, little shovels, all kinds of stuff that didn't amount to anything. As a friend of mine likes to say, all hat, no cattle. And we went through 4 years of the show. We got the show and nothing to show for it. This administration, not really putting on the show. I'd like to see a little more glitz, a little more glamour. I'd like to see, you know, big giant signs of Joe Biden pointing at stuff going, I did that. I would love to see it, you know, cemented in the side of the side of the wall saying, hey, right here, buddy, I did this. And taking some credit for it and doing it in a way that, well, you know, a little swagger, because I think it's well-earned, well-deserved. You know, there's the difference between being, you know, overconfident and, you know, that swaggering you-know-what for no reason. And then there's having a little hop in your step that makes you go, yeah, I got it. I did it. That's where Biden should be, because we are rebuilding stuff. And look, for me, talking about Infrastructure Week is talking about opportunities. Talking about the future, what could be. You know, in this country, we used to, and I guess it's just because I'm getting a little bit older, but we used to want to compete at the edge of technology. We wanted to go up until the edge of possible and peer into the abyss of what possibilities could be. We used to be that country, and we can be again. You know, I think back to, you know, before I was born, that early 60s, and it, look, that going to the moon, that shooting for the stars, that mentality, you know, I kind of grew up, even as poor as we were, believing that in this country we could do amazing things. I don't know that we're there. And I go back to the destruction of the space program. Thank you, Richard Milhouse Nixon. That was really the beginning of crushing the dreams of what is possible. The dreams of what's on that outer edge. And I think that's been exported. You know, I've used the quote from Thomas Friedman. It's been years since he said it. But he said he had traveled from Beijing to LAX, and it was like going from the Jetsons to the Flintstones. We had fallen that far back. That China is building and had been building at an amazing pace. Pushing technology. And we're kind of just sitting back on our laurels. I look at this infrastructure bill as an opportunity, not just to grow our economy and create jobs and make us more competitive and all of that stuff, but as moving us back towards this idea of innovation, this idea of driving new technology, of driving new solutions for better living, better opportunities. And I know, Rick, you're crazy that how do you get there? It's just a road. Yeah, but that road goes somewhere, man. You know, I remember when everyone was upset about the bridge to nowhere. You know, they built a bridge to nowhere. And I go, yeah, but once you build that bridge, it goes somewhere. And the possibilities of that going somewhere, to me, is what's really exciting. And I guess this is where, you know, as a kid growing up in the sci-fi, reading Omni magazine and Ray Bradbury and wanting this future, the Jetsons, where life gets easier and better for working people, where opportunities of reaching that self-attainment, that self-actualization, that's enticing to me. It makes me go, hey, we can still do great things. We can be that country that does amazing stuff because we have the talent. But do we have the will? And I look at this infrastructure bill that says, look, we're gonna rebuild the roads and bridges. We're gonna modernize our ports. We're gonna modernize our broadband. We're gonna do all of this stuff that's been neglected for decades. Because understand, most of the investments that we're living off of were either during the FDR era or the Eisenhower era. Yeah, we've tinkered around the edges and done some little things here and there, but you know, Nixon forward, it's been all just about serving the self and the ego, the individual. Hooray for me and the heck with everybody else, as long as I get mine. Without thinking that, you know what? Big infrastructure, big investments in public works, it helps all of us, individual and community. Now you go, but Rick, we don't do anything in this country unless it means national security. And this is true. You know, you go back to the Eisenhower years. The reason we've got this incredible highway system that was built, because we needed to, Eisenhower liked how they moved bombs around in Germany. And we wanted to be able to move bombs around here. And what we've done is we've given soccer moms an opportunity to take the kids to soccer practice faster. That's great too. But if we have to do it from a national security position, the idea that, we rebuild our infrastructure so that we can protect it, so that we can protect our critical infrastructure from attacks seems reasonable. The fact that we want to prepare for emergencies and be prepared and be able to respond, that's huge too. And look, there's border security issues, there's military readiness, there's cybersecurity, there's all of this stuff that if you need a national security reason, if you need a militaristic reason, it's there. But still, you know, as a kid who grew up imagining what it was like to be on the moon, what NASA's mission had been before Nixon, we can do great things. And this is that beginning of it. This is the start of potentially that ability to give my kids and the next generations the opportunity to dream, the opportunity to go, hey, we can build a road to nowhere and make it somewhere great. That we can do amazing things and leave for future generations things that they'll want to inherit. I mean, I think back to the, you know, to the FDR years and the CCC things, you know, projects that went on. We still have those national parks. We still have those investments today that they made oh so many years ago. So for me, it really is about, you know, building and taking this moment. Not just for our short-term needs of the jobs and the products to market and all of the reasons that they give us why, you know, we need to have infrastructure so it's good for business. But no, for that idea that we're going to build a future for our kids worth inheriting. And we're going to push that technology all the way to the edge to get us where I think we all want to be. So when Infrastructure Week pops up, for me, it's about more than just concrete and steel. It's about hopes and dreams. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday, President Biden tweeted out, Infrastructure Week was a punchline during the previous administration. On my watch, we're seeing shovels in the ground, cranes going up, and people hard at work rebuilding America. He says, we're not just delivering an Infrastructure Week. We're delivering an infrastructure decade. And look, yeah, there are things being done. There are little cones all over the place and small signs saying this is brought to you by the Inflation Reduction Act. This is brought to you by the bipartisan infrastructure bill. There's a little sign. I think it needs to be much bigger considering most people don't even know that it got passed. And who did it? I'm here to share some thoughts on Infrastructure Week. Asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's great to be with you.
So National Infrastructure Week during the Trump years, we had that. It seemed like every week was National Infrastructure Week where we had cute little photo ops and we had all kinds of gimmicky stuff. No shovels in the ground, no things being rebuilt, but actually now doing something.
Yeah. I think part of the reason why people don't know about this is because when things are going right, you don't hear a lot, right? Unfortunately, y'all, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, so to speak. But this is a generational policy that people will be able to see, feel, benefit from in the very near future. Some already. I mean, you know, this is leveraging like $1.2 trillion in infrastructure investment over, you know, 5 or 6 years. And some of that is what we say out the door already. But a lot of that is yet to come. too. And you're going to see it in the form of amazing new bridges, in a better rail and transit system, in better broadband, in ports that are modern, and lots of other types of infrastructure as well. I think, unfortunately, what happens is that everybody claims credit for getting the money, you know, whether it's the mayor or the member of Congress, even though they voted against it, or the governor, even though they may not want to give any political acknowledgement to the president if he's in the other party. By the time you get your way up to the president, I guess it seems fairly removed from all that. But it is important to remember that none of this would be happening were it not for the leadership of President Biden and the Senate and the House, Democrats, and in this case, Rick, some Republicans as well that helped to make it happen.
Yeah.
But it is a celebration. I mean, I remember all these infrastructure weeks because we used to say, we got to do this. And so finally, we did it. And now, yeah, it's kind of like, let's get the money out the door. Let's get the word out and let's make sure that people know how this is going to benefit them, and also ask them what else needs to be done. I mean, what other bridges do we need to build? What other roads do we need to improve? What other rails do we need to make into like high speed rail or mass transit for folks? Yeah. So good news stories don't nearly get the ink as the red alerts and the loud sirens, do they?
Yeah, to be honest, from 2011 until 2021, I was saying that someone should build an app that would say when you're going over a structurally deficient bridge, right, let's say, it would send you a text going, hey, call mom. You might not make it to the other side. That there should be something that says, hey, we've got problems here. And now I'm thinking, we build that app that sends you a text to go, hey, Joe Biden did that. Or maybe in cement, we imprint that picture of Biden did that on the side of that thing so people don't forget.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. You're right. Not a lot of people know about this, in part because it's not much of a political flashpoint. Right. I mean, it's not like an issue like Israel, Palestine, or some of these other, abortion or what have you. It's like, who doesn't want better roads and bridges? I mean, it's not like,
and the jobs, right, that come with it. I mean, the reality is
the jobs. Yeah.
Yeah. Not just the jobs of building this stuff, but also the materials that go in this. And this is why I think, again, part of the Biden administration's push for Buy American is so important.
Yeah. And there is, and you will see in the kinds of factories that make things that go into infrastructure, like rebar, structural steel, cement, and tons of other things, they're busy. I mean, they're busy, and so they're hiring, and they're busy, and in some cases, it's basically like, where can we get the bodies to work in the factory? Right. Yeah. I mean, in some cases. And so which is a good problem to have. But again, unfortunately, because this is something that has gone right and that a lot of people take for granted and it's hard to identify who the true, who the true author of the resources were. I think you're right. I don't think Biden gets nearly enough credit, and probably the members of Congress who passed this also probably don't get nearly enough credit for doing something that is transformational for our country, that is only going to help us, yep, which is very rare to say about any public policy. This is a 100% across the board benefit to the United States of America.
Yeah, but I also agree that the president needs to hammer more on the fact that, during the Trump years, infrastructure was a punchline. It was a photo op. It was a gimmick. Nothing got done because a lot of my red hat friends, they think Trump did all this stuff. And the reality is he did not. I want to change gears here a little bit because yesterday on the program, We had our friend Emily De La Bria on to talk about, you know, China and the you know, what was going on in Hungary and all that stuff. But she had something that I wanted to throw out at you. She said that there's nothing in this country that's made today of any substance that we can build without China, that we're dependent on China for some input. And I remember going, you know, wow, that's an incredible statement. And then she threw it back at me saying, you know, name something that we've done. And I couldn't. So you, as the manufacturing guru, you are the guy who is this an accurate statement? Or, and if it isn't an accurate statement, can we envision a world where it is?
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, Emily is I think correct about this. And I, you know, someone can go out there and find something, I'm sure. But as I think about it, and in particular, you know, a lot of the complex goods that are made, whether that it's in microelectronics or autos or aerospace or what have you, you know, even if we do have a big foundation for that industry in the United States, there's a lot of parts in the supply chain where China may be the sole source or the predominant source. And that's true on things like mineral processing, where, you know, it's 90% or, you know, graphite, which goes into lithium ion batteries, where, you know, China has like 90% of the production. So it really is hard to find. I think that is, you know, that should be eye-opening. I think some people saw that when it came to PPE and active pharmaceutical ingredients, you know, and they really felt that. But it is a, you know, it's a problem that does not have an easy solution and will take time. I will say, Rick, that I think that, you know, a couple of good things that this administration has done is they did a massive kind of supply chain review to look at the vulnerabilities that we have just like this. And it is a, it will make for boring reading for most people. It's like 1400 pages long, but it goes into great detail about what we make, what we don't make, why that's a problem. So identifying it is the first step. Second, we do have some tariffs. We do have some of these other incentives to manufacture in the United States. And so this is not going to capture 100% of that. But I do think that we have probably reached peak China when it comes to this. And we're slowly beginning that process of unwinding. I would like to see it accelerated, of course. But I do think that there is, to Emily's point, that there is like now a great deal of awareness of this, and also in many ways a varying degrees of a policy response that's underway, which gives me some hope. We have a long way to go. Believe me, we have a long, long, long way to go. But we're not like either flying blind or just ignoring the problem, which is what we did for 20 or 30 years.
No, we were sold on the idea we're going to get cheap stuff and there'll be no consequences. So for me, this is a unifying issue. This should bring right, left, you know, everyone. This should bring people together and go, look, is this a direction we want to continue? You said you think we've hit peak China. I fear we haven't. I fear there's a day down the road when everything is made in China, when, you know, when every vehicle is made, all of our clothing, everything, and we're that dependent if we make bad choices now, which is why I look at the Biden administration now, you know, talking about EVs. You know, vehicle production in this country is a huge driver of manufacturing jobs. It's a huge driver of revenue and you know, and keeping communities afloat. If we lose that capacity as we transition to new kind of vehicles, I fear what is left of our tattered middle class is completely eviscerated.
Yeah, well, you're right to be concerned about that. I'm also concerned about that, and I do think that the good news or the silver lining in this is that we do have some control over the situation. This isn't just about some mythical invisible hand that's gonna swipe everything away from the United States and send it to China. This is about deliberate policy choices, right? And so we do have a chance to make this right, but and vehicles may be the most important point here. because China's become the largest vehicle manufacturer in the world, the largest vehicle exporter in the world, and has a massive amount of vehicle production capacity in the United States that can't be soaked up by its own people. In fact, it's probably 5 or 10 million vehicles. The U.S. sells about 15 million cars a year in the United States, and some of that is domestic, some of that's import. But if you think about the scale of China's overproduction there, and it could really wipe out our industry. We called it an extinction level event in a report we did, and I think that is right. And so I am worried about that. I guess I'm the policy optimist that kind of like is like, okay, I think people generally get it, but I think it's also important to understand that, you know, that having the right amount of tariffs, but you also need that investment to make sure that manufacturing comes to the United States, because it just doesn't, you just can't snap your fingers and make it happen. You actually have to have some incentives to produce here, some incentives for consumers to buy it. If it's made in the United States, and believe me, every other country has something like this. We're not alone. In fact, we're behind in some respects. We could end up with a problem if we don't do that. And if Trump, for instance, wants to take the investments away, that will be a disaster. You know, I mean, he'll use it as a talking point, but that will be a disaster for it, because that stuff will find its way here.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't come directly from China, it will come indirectly from another country that a Chinese company is partnering with to get it around the tariffs in the United States. That would be bad.
A couple of things that caught my attention. You said, you know, it's no longer about the invisible hand, that policy can work. That is a major shift of thought, you know, over the last 50 years of conservative economics. I mean, this idea that, you know, this invisible hand is guiding the economy, which I've never bought into, but that is a major cultural shift, I think. But the other part of it, and this is where I don't share your optimism, I fear that we're addicted to cheap. Because I've had people tell me, well, what's wrong with letting the Chinese EVs into the country if they're $10,000? It'll give low-income people the ability to buy these things. It'll move us quicker. I mean, there's an argument out there to allowing Chinese vehicles and cheap Chinese stuff in. I just don't agree with it on any level, but there are people out there trying to make it.
Yeah, they are. And I think, unfortunately, what ends up happening is those companies wipe out the rest of the competition, then they're free to set the price what they want. And it's not always going to work out well for the American consumer. And they're not going to put the American consumer first. Believe me, they're not. That's going to be like their fourth or fifth priority. So it's much better to have some control over the situation and to be able to build some capacity in the United States. And once you build that scale and get that efficiency, yes, you can get the prices down to a reasonable level. It's also really unfair because no company tells the consumers that we're able to offer this to you at this impossibly low price because we exploit labor, because we pollute the environment, because we take advantage of subsidies in China, and that you know, we get this great you know, currency rate because of currency manipulation and all of this stuff. They don't disclose any of that. So you're right. The consumers think they get this awesome deal. And so there's got to be more exposure about what companies are doing to do this. And believe me, the companies are doing quite well. And honestly, they would do well if they shifted their production back to the United States as well. It's just that they couldn't do business as usual, which is not, you know, not going to make China a wealthier place or our own workers, Rick.
Well, it'll be interesting to see, because I look at this, the Biden administration's push to put some tariffs on these EVs. I see this as kind of like one of the last hills in the battle. If this goes the wrong way, if we lose this, I fear manufacturing as a whole goes away. But that's my thought.
Yeah. I think you're right. And the important thing about this with the EVs is they're doing this before the fact. Okay. You know, we don't see this onslaught of Chinese EVs right now, like we have with other stuff that's completely wiped out industries in the United States and really cut down the number of factories here, whether it's in glass or aluminum or steel or paper or tires or you name it, or microelectronics. And so I give this administration a massive amount of credit for recognizing this before it's about to happen. It's like that, what was it, future crime or whatever, you know?
No, it's just being proactive. But it's going, look, we know what's coming. We're going to prepare.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong.
Yeah.
You know that Boy Scout motto, always be prepared. It's about damn time we got somebody who's prepared.
Exactly right. And so this is one piece of that. There's other things that we'll need to continue working on, but this is a big piece of that. It sends a message, and it also makes it very cost prohibitive for those companies to send the vehicles.
There
to
you
the
go.
US.
Scott, as always, appreciate the time. Great stuff. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks so much for having me on, Rick. Appreciate it.
Anytime, our good friend Scott Paul. I want to hear your thoughts. Do you want Chinese EVs, or do you see it as I do? The end of making anything in this country, because our auto industry is so, so important to manufacturing. Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed. Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see mostly clear skies here the overnight with light winds, and that means a little frost will be possible by early Wednesday morning as our lows drop to the mid-30s. Wednesday itself, we'll see mostly sunny skies, highs in the upper 60s, close to 70 degrees. Currently 44 degrees.
Matt Nair on air.
Dr. Karen Tamarius, she's a political psychiatrist, and we're talking about how to talk to people with which we do not agree.
Think of the mind as a rider on an elephant. The conscious part is the rider, and the emotional part is the elephant. If you want the person to change their mind, you need to talk with the elephant, not the rider.
Matt Nair on air, weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So back on May 2nd, Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts, Senator Tina Smith of Minnesota, a number of labor leaders, some warehouse workers, all converged on the U.S. Capitol, held a press conference introducing the Warehouse Worker Protection Act. And the stated goal of this act would be to hold Amazon accountable for its dangerously unsafe practices and abusive production quotas. Because as we've talked about, Amazon is number one in the injury game. And the question is, how do we protect workers, and will this be it? And that's why I've asked Irene Tong to come talk with us. Irene is a senior researcher and policy analyst there at the National Employment Law Project. Irene, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So what is this this Warehouse Worker Protection Act? What's the idea? Am I right? Is the stated goal pursuing Amazon? What's the point?
Well, Amazon is certainly a central player in the warehouse industry, as you just said. They are, and not only that, in the U.S. economy, they are now the second largest private sector employer in the United States. They are the largest employer in, I think, New Jersey, California, Washington State. So definitely Amazon is part of the story. But, you know, the warehousing sector has grown overall in this country. And so it's not just Amazon. I mean, you know, other companies would be covered here as well. And, you know, it's really preventing Amazon's harmful management practices from spreading to across the warehousing industry.
Yeah, because race to the bottom seems to be what takes hold. So if you allow Amazon, who right now is number one in the injury game and in the surveillance and the quotas and all this stuff game, it will then spread. Because here's the thing. I don't know if you've done much driving in some rural areas, but where I live in Pennsylvania here, the central part of the state, we're nothing but warehouses, it seems like. Every time you go, hey, didn't there used to be a farm over there? Yeah, it's now this behemoth of a warehouse. So this seems to be the direction that we're going. We don't make much, but we know how to warehouse it.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the warehouse industry is one of the fastest growing industries in many parts of the country. And, you know, if these are the jobs that are going to be there, we have to figure out how to make these jobs safe and make these jobs pay well and make these jobs sustainable and long-term for families. And Amazon certainly is not doing that.
Yeah, well, you know, look, as a 35-year union member, you know, for me, the answer to this is we pass labor law reform. We allow people to join and form unions. We have a government that promotes collective bargaining again, as we had in the past. And in individual workplaces, we negotiate for better wages, hours, conditions, so that this isn't happening across the board. But sadly, we're not in that world. But for me, unions, that's for me the way forward.
Absolutely. And I think that this bill that was introduced a couple weeks ago, and also the state bills and the state laws that have been passed, have really been crafted by worker groups and unions in the context of these organizing efforts and workers, Amazon workers around the country looking to form unions and get a fair contract at Amazon. And so, you know, that was part of the why for these bills, you know, recognizing that alongside all of the union organizing, the laws have not kept up at all. You know, the laws have not kept up with Amazon's surveillance. They have not kept up with the way that Amazon pushes workers in unsafe ways. And so, you know, we need exactly, as you said, labor law reform, and we also need these other kinds of protections for workers so that Amazon can't just retaliate against workers using all of these mountains of data that they collect, right? You know, they collect the data, they say it's for productivity, but then when a worker goes and points out that they've been fired for a retaliatory reason, Amazon comes back with this mountain of data. And, you know, it is absolutely an uneven playing field in terms of in terms of the organizing.
And they do collect a lot of data. So, but, you know, Amazon is the big player in the room. They're the driver of what the industry will look like, because that's how it works. The big boy, that sets the direction. And the question that I have is, how bad is Amazon? I mean, compared to other, you know, somewhat competitors, you know, how much worse are they? And I've seen some statements and some statistics, but I'm curious from your perspective, you know, how bad is it for folks?
Amazon, the injury rates that they self-report to OSHA are much higher than for comparable employers. So, you know, right now it's something like one in 15, there's one very serious injury for every 15 workers a year. And so, and this is not a paper cut. You know, 95% of these injuries require workers to miss days of work or be transferred to light duty. So this is, you know, one in 15. And that is, you know, Amazon has been congratulating itself that that's down from, you know, one in nine or something like that.
Wow.
A few years ago.
No, just to imagine this. I mean, you know, let's say there's, you know, 500 people that work at the Amazon warehouse. You line them all up and go count off one to 15. Number one, you're going to get hurt. Somebody's going to get hurt of that 15 this year. That's staggering. One of the stats that I saw is, you know, Amazon's injury rate was compared to TJ Maxx Corporation, their TJ Maxx, Marshalls, and other retailers, was 1.5 times higher. So it's we're not talking just a little bit worse off. We're talking a lot worse.
That's right. And about three, you know, our research showed that it was three times the injury rate for Walmart warehouses specifically.
So worse than Walmart.
Yes.
That's an achievement. Congratulations. I guess that is an achievement. So this is why, again, when you have these things pop up, there has to be a response. Workers get to organize, or we start passing laws. So what are the chances of this passing in this world? Because look, understand, Republicans control the House. I know the Democrats control the Senate. Markey has put this forth. The hope is it goes through the Senate. What are the chances of this getting through the House? Because I know my Republican friends are trying to make a play for working people and trying to make this pivot that they seem to care. This seems like a care issue. Shouldn't be red hat, blue hat. This should be a hard hat issue.
Yeah, you would think so. And I know that there has been some Republican interest in this bill, which is very, very encouraging, I think. You know, I I think we can just hope that the Republicans will come to the table and will recognize how this is an issue across red states and blue states and take some action.
Because ultimately this is, I would argue, a pro company bill, because not having injured workers means you're saving money. You're not losing days for workers who are doing the job. It seems like there's good arguments for corporations to want to ensure that their workers are safe and do the right thing. And I know that's a pipe dream, and I'm hoping, but it seems like you would want that, no?
You would think so. I mean, OSHA itself has estimated that cost tens of thousands of dollars for every single workplace injury for companies in terms of turnover, lost work, lost productivity, et cetera. But Amazon in particular has pioneered this business model in which the high turnover is part of the way that they do business. They don't actually want people to stick around.
Right.
Right. And some people have put two and two together and thought, well, maybe this has something to do with discouraging unionization. I mean, we can't say for sure, but my research has shown that the turnover rate at Amazon is up to 150% each year. If you can imagine that, that means that people are not staying for an entire year on average. So you think about, what it takes to organize a union. It's a lot easier to keep the union out if you just keep people, churning through.
Or the other side of this, you have the highest injury rates in the industry. You want to use people up as fast as possible and get them out the door before they get injured. Or when they get injured, you get rid of them. Seems like a business model. But what do you say now? Because I'm hearing a lot of this going, well, we can't be too hard on these companies, Rick, because they'll just automate. AI is coming. Robotics are coming. My response is one. When it becomes cost effective for them to replace people, they are certainly going to do, regardless of what it costs. And two, that shouldn't stop us from protecting people now. But I'm curious your thoughts.
No, absolutely. But I mean, I think, if they could have automated these jobs, they would have already, right? And so I think that they still need human beings right now. And the way that they have designed these jobs is that they use the technology to force people to work as much like robots as they can. And so, are the robots going to take our jobs, or are we going to become the robots is really a big question based on how, if you can imagine, every movement is being monitored in this way so that workers have no choice even over how they move their bodies.
Yeah, no, my son just yesterday said, what do you think about this, this tool that employers are using that measures people's body language? It's just measuring your body language and how effective you are as a worker. And I'm going, no, I think that's a horrible thing. I think it's bad when you micromanage thoughts and eye movements to the point to where we're trying to maximize productivity on all of those levels. Because just what you said, we're just turning people into robots.
Right, right. I mean, you think that technology, when we think about technology, it should be something that helps human beings, makes things easier, makes our workloads lighter. But there's actually, people have looked at how Amazon has used robotics, and the workers get hurt more in the warehouses that have more robotics, because the way Amazon has designed it, the people have to contort their bodies to keep up with the robotics, as opposed to the robotics helping to make the jobs easier. And that's just, that's one of the reasons that we need lawmakers to step in and really create some standards
It would have been nice to be a little more proactive in this arena, because I've had people tell me that you've got this wrist thing, you've got this handheld thing that's constantly barking at you, hey, pick something up, hey, do something, constantly monitoring your every movement. That can't be good for your mental health. Granted, physically you know, the constant pushing to the maximum, that's not great. But also the mental part of this, I can't imagine is good either. Does this Warehouse Worker Protection Act cover anything mental with the stress of these heightened quotas and all of this kind of just constant harassment? Thoughts? Yes? No?
No, absolutely. I think, you know, the one of the central problems with these new surveillance technologies is that workers don't know what the performance standard is that they're being held to. That is what creates this climate of fear. You know, you have this. And so that's one of the first things that this bill does is says you have to tell people what the performance standard is. You can't just, you can't punish somebody until you've told them what the performance standard is. And that, we think, you know, addresses this kind of lack of information and sort of secrecy that surrounds these quotas, which is what leads to a lot of the stress. So Amazon, for example, they will punish people who are at the bottom, you know, X percentile, bottom fifth percentile. That's like grading on a curve, right? And we all know how grading on a curve creates all kinds of stress because you have no idea where you stand at any moment at all. And so, you know, that part of these bills is what kind of tries to cut to the heart of the problems with these new.
I go back to where I started this, why I'm a supporter of labor unions, all this stuff written down in a contract, no surprises, no mystery, wages, hours, conditions, everything in black and white. So there's nothing vague about it. There's no mystery. You know what's expected of you. And it seems to me, again, something we should be pushing forward. So last line of questioning I've got for you, how do we get this pushed through? And are there places around the country that are doing this, that have passed this kind of legislation, and has it helped? So it's a bunch in there, but are there places that have done this?
Yes. So there are now 5 states that have passed similar bills, started in California, with AB 701, and then New York State, Washington State, Minnesota, and then just last month, Oregon. And, you know, so it's still very early, but we have heard reports from these various states, from workers, that it has made a difference in their warehouses. They have been able to use the laws to, you know, demand changes from their managers and improve working conditions. So we think that, you know, this is fantastic news. And I think that, you know, the federal government can actually go a little bit farther, and it does in this bill, in terms of, you know, mandating that the jobs are designed in a way that protects workers' bodies, you know, in terms of an ergonomic standard, and also making sure that that the companies have proper medical management procedures so that if somebody does get injured, they're cared for properly on site and also referred out to a doctor if the injury is serious enough. And that is not happening right now.
Yeah, and there's a whole nother conversation about
implications for workers' comp.
Yeah,
as well,
no, so. I was just going to go there. It's a whole nother conversation about how badly beaten up our workers' compensation laws have been over the last 20 years, 30 years, here in Pennsylvania especially. But I hope this can move. Real quick, yes or no, do you think this gets through in this Congress, or is this something that is, you know, maybe next time around?
I'm hopeful. I'm very, very hopeful, but I think that we are also digging in for a longer fight.
For the long haul. Irene Tong, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Good stuff.
Thank you so much, Rick, for having me on the show.
Thanks so much. Irene's a senior researcher and policy analyst there at the National Employment Law Project. Make sure you check out their work, NELP.org. We'll get links out on social media. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. You ever enjoy a cold beer after a long day's work? Well, if you were a worker in the United States from 1920 to 1933, you would have to break the law to down a brew. And on this day in labor history, the year was 1932. That was the day that massive demonstrations for the re-legalization of beer were held in New York City and Detroit. Prohibition had lasted for more than a decade. the outcry for the repeal of the alcohol ban was growing. Mayor Jimmy Walker of New York City decided to hold a parade to support what he called beer for taxation. Mayor Walker argued that allowing the sale of beer would provide more taxes for the federal coffers. Getting beer brewing up and running again would also help cut unemployment, a serious issue in the midst of the Great Depression. 100,000 people answered the mayor's call and marched in the streets for beer. That same day in Detroit, 40,000 marched for beer. Many in the crowd were from the city's working class. One float in the Detroit parade bore a sign that read, "Beer," in giant letters. Around the one-word demand was printed the words farmers, masons, coopers, tinsmiths, carpenters, brewers, and porters. Workers of all types wanted their beer back. Participants in the parade chanted, "Who wants beer? We do!" A little less than a year later, the government answered their call and ended prohibition.
One, two, three. Beer, 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 Jimmy, beer, beer, beer.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
One, two.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So by all means, call your member of Congress, say you want them to support the Warehouse Worker Protection Act. Because again, this is one of those things I think really important, that this is the future. These are the jobs of the future, or they're the jobs of right now and of the future. And what I find interesting is whenever I talk about this, and save me the email traffic, because I've already had this, and we've had this conversation before, is that, well, you know, if you put too many of these regulations on corporations, they're going to automate. If you demand too much, ask too much, they're going to do away with you. There's that, you know, hey, don't rock the boat, you know, don't demand too much. And I got to tell you, I think back to my grandparents, and I think back to that mentality that if my work is creating some wealth, I want a part of that. You know, I was just having a conversation with someone over the weekend. I said, look, you know, the reason that I'm a big union supporter is because it forces corporations to open their books. Look, I believe in all the camaraderie. I believe in all the solidarity. I believe in all of the, to my core, I believe in all of those things that I think unions do well. But at the end of the day, it really is about opening up the books. It's about going, okay, this is what we've made off of the labor that we're using. This is what we've made off of your blood, sweat, and tears. This is what we've made off of the hours of your life. This is what you are worth to us. That's the reality. And I don't know that we boil it down to that level enough. Look, we talk about the high-minded stuff, the solidarity, the empowerment that workers have in the workplace to do the right thing, to not, you know, work in unsafe conditions, to have a say in, you know, how their work is done, all those things that are amazing and I think really important to emphasize. But at the end of the day, when the rubber meets the road, it's about opening up the books. It's about going, okay, how much is Amazon making? And how much is our labor worth? Because, again, we're told that wages are set by the market. But how can you set a price for something if you don't know its worth? You know, I've done this experiment over the years where I've asked people, you know, how much do you think your time is worth? How much would it cost me to have you just come stand in my driveway in the middle of January? I don't need you to do anything. I just want you to stand there. How much would that cost? How much is your time worth? Because ultimately, that's what we're talking about. You're trading hours of your life for wages to be able to support your family and lead the kind of life that you want. Put food on the table for your kids so that they don't go hungry. Ultimately, that's why we work. Now, look, there's some satisfaction, and I get that.
There truly is a therapeutic quality to, a job well done. Knowing that you've made your way, knowing that you've completed a task, knowing that you've done well. I agree with that. But ultimately, at the end of the day, back to the rubber and the road, it's about the wages. And unions force the books open. Because understand, when corporations are doing poorly, what do? They always come back and go, hey, we need concessions. And here, look, we're losing money. See, save us. Take pay cuts, take benefit cuts. Help us, do all this other different stuff. They never, never don't ask. And if there's no union in place, they just impose. There's no asking. We're cutting wages. We're cutting benefits. We're cutting, safety procedures. We're slashing and burning to save ourselves. You are secondary. You are a negative on a balance sheet. And I hate being that kind of harsh reality, but that's what it is. So as I was talking to this person, I said, look, at the end of the day, it's about opening up those books and finding out, how much your labor is worth. If you were making $20 an hour and you found out the company was making $1,000 an hour off of your labor, do you think your labor is worth more than 20 bucks an hour? And you would have the bargaining power to say, hey, for me to keep doing this, I demand a little bit more. And the person answered, well, of course, if I knew. And that's the difference. Most people don't know. So when you ask them how much is your labor worth, most people don't have that answer, especially most hourly workers. They'll usually say, what I'm getting paid, that's what the market says. No, that's what the employer says. That's what an industry says that's figured out how to try and hold wages down. Because understand, I use the trucking industry where I'm intimately knowledgeable. When I started in the LTL industry back in the 80s, wages were significantly higher because 85% of the industry was unionized. Significantly higher. Whereas, today, union density is down to a very small amount, I think 10% maybe. And wages are, let's say, 30% lower than they were when I started. Still a reasonable wage, still a wage you can put some food on the table and something of a roof over your head, but not like it was. And this is where you go, do workers know what their value is? These companies are making money. They're making lots of money. They're just not sharing it with the people who actually earn it. This is where I love the, you don't know what it's like to sign the front of a paycheck. I do actually, but I also know what's possible. And the only way that you get to know that is by going, hey, look, this is what revenue comes in. This is what your labor creates. So for me, that's the issue. And the more of that we have, the better, I think. Do I think it's going to happen anytime in the near future? No, sadly, we're not that country yet. You would have thought coming out of the pandemic, there would have been a mass mobilization. We're seeing lots of activity, but still not where I would like it to believe, because I just don't know that we're asking that question. How much am I worth? I hear a lot of complaining. Inflation's high. It's the price's fault. No, it's the wages' fault. Because in the 70s, when prices were going up, wages did too. And I use my grandparents again. When they bought their home in the 60s, it was a struggle. The monthly mortgage was tough. It was a week's pay. By the end of the 70s, 12, 13 years later, it was a day's pay. Because their union contracts had cost of living adjustments, whereas where if the inflation went up, wages went up. And oh, by the way, at contract time, they sat down and they negotiated for better wages to keep up so that your standard of living didn't fall. The reason we're getting crushed by inflation right now and have been for the last 40 years is because we don't have those unions fighting for us like we did back during my grandparents' generation. So for me, the answer has always been, you want to reunite the country? You want to reinvigorate the American dream? Reunionize. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Grab the podcast. Always there, always available. Freespeech.org for video. Thanks for being here. See you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com.
This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.